Welcome everyone to another episode of Compressed FM, a podcast all about web development and design with a little bit of zest. In this episode, we're going to talk about something that I don't even know how to begin to think about, which is composable decoupled front ends. So super excited to learn about that in this episode.
Web development and design, who would have guessed? Well, we can do them both, even add a little zest. So turn up the volume, get ready for the best. Let's get it started in this episode of Compressed.
What's up, everyone? My name is James Q. Quick, and I am a full-time technical content creator.
Hello, my name is Amy Dutton, and I am the director of design at Zeal.
And we are joined by an amazing guest. We were talking about this earlier. Natalia and I have met twice. Amy, y'all have met either once or twice. Have you met us? You met twice as well? Jealous. Did you meet at Jamstack.conf?
Everybody.
I feel like I was telling somebody earlier, I feel like I hear this 50 times a day about people, how they met at Jamstack.conf, and I'm super jealous. All of that aside, I'm super excited to have Natalia on the stream. Natalia, do you want to introduce yourself and tell people a little bit about your background?
Sure. So yeah, thank you for having me. I'm Natalia. And this is the perfect podcast for me because I started as a designer back in the day and a graphic designer. And then I transitioned to be a web developer. And then that's been like many years ago. I don't want to say how many, but many. And now I am a program manager at Microsoft. I lead the developer experience for JavaScript and Node.js developers across our many services. So yes, I build and deploy applications all day to find how to make the developer experience amazing for everyone. But yeah, in the middle, I've been a front-end developer, full-stack developer, software architect, and anything you can think of in the tech world, I had that role. Yeah.
Just out of curiosity, what was your transition like into web development, and why did you want to do that? What was interesting about transitioning for you?
Well, because that happened basically when everything else was transitioning from being something printed and offset to being in the digital world. And I was working for a magazine that was printed, and I realized that we were losing audience because everybody was now browsing online. And I told my back in the day manager, let's try to have this as a portal back in the day. And he said, like, yeah, but we need developers for that. And I'm like, I'll try to be a developer. I'll learn. And he was like, okay, you can try. And that was how I started designing dynamic banners with Flash. That was my first programming experience. And then I moved on to PHP and JavaScript and HTML and CSS and the whole thing and databases. And that was like, yeah, a point of inflection. I never went back to design. In fact, I'm an awful designer right now. I'm out of practice. Yeah. I don't have patience, which is very important. I'm out of touch with the design communities. So yeah, I don't even have patience with Figma. So when I go to Figma, I'm like, what's this? I don't know how to do anything anymore. Yeah.
You have officially crossed over to the developer side.
yeah. Officially, like, there is no way back for me anymore. Yeah.
There's a question in the chat. Do you have Quark experience?
Quark. Yes, I have Quark experience. That was one of the first. Yeah, I have.
I don't
Quark.
Even know what that is.
It was an application to lay out magazines. So that was what I was using, that and Freehand, when Freehand was not Adobe, but Macromedia.
Yes.
Yeah.
So awesome.
Yeah.
I always love a good conversation about older programs.
Yeah.
CorelDRAW.
Definitely used. And in fact, I am super fast at tracing. Like, I haven't lost that skill. So if I have to trace something, an SVG, for example, I can do it super quickly, which is, one skill that I haven't lost. So, yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah. This is where
the pen tool is definitely a skill.
This is where I don't fit into these conversations. Every time it's like, oh, I remember the web when blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, no. Because I started basically in 2016. I don't know if, Natalia, you knew this. I started in my career in 2013, started doing web stuff in 2016. But I started at Microsoft as a technical evangelist at the time, was focused on more mobile apps and like getting into the focus on cloud, which I think is a lot now. Do you want to kind of give like an intro or overview of what JavaScript on Azure looks like? Like, I assume Node.js backends is probably part of that, but then we have all these frameworks and then integrations with frameworks and doing builds and stuff on the server. Like, what does the landscape of JavaScript on Azure look like now?
Yeah, well, we have several services where you can deploy JavaScript to. Obviously, the two most relevant for front-end developers would be Azure Static Web Apps, where you can deploy static applications. And then, obviously, functions. We have Node.js functions. But you can also containerize applications, like Node.js applications, and deploy them to Azure Container Apps, to containers, to AKS, to wherever you may decide. But my focus is strongly in Azure Static Web Apps, functions, and the databases that we integrate with. And the whole ecosystem, right? VS Code extensions that help you do that, our integrations with GitHub. Yeah, this is where I spend most of my time.
I will say it's amazing to see the perspective of Microsoft and the developer communities now versus when I started at Microsoft, which is 2013. And Microsoft was desperate to get like any bit of trust, honestly, with developers, because it just wasn't the company that developers were like, this is the thing that supports open source and has the tools and stuff that I need. So it's really incredible to see the transition that Microsoft has gone through from like cloud to VS Code being so huge, the integration of GitHub, like acquiring and then integrating GitHub, I feel like people were really skeptical of, but it's worked out so well because there's been so many amazing features added to GitHub. And then obviously integrations with like Azure and GitHub are going to be really top notch. So it's really fun to watch all the amazing stuff that Microsoft is doing these days.
Absolutely. And there are things that happen behind the scenes that people are not aware of. For example, I have conversations with the Node.js core team frequently, where we try to make sure that the experience for Node.js developers on Windows has parity with that on other operating systems. And there's a lot that we do to make sure that developers feel at home and meet them where they are at. So yeah, I am very proud of what we are accomplishing.
Absolutely. Do you want to introduce us to the concept of composable decoupled front ends? I probably have a guess at what this means, but I really don't have much more than a guess. So do you want to give us like an introduction to what that is and what that looks like?
Sure. I think that stems, basically it's a next, how do I say this? The next thing after Jamstack and micro frontends. So these are two concepts that we have been hearing about in architecture, or patterns that have been explored for a while. But they have the root in on-premise deployments, right? When you think about it, we started modularizing because monoliths started becoming larger. And that happened when 100% of the deployments were on-premise. And now we have, I don't know, I don't have a number. I don't want to say anything that is incorrect, but we have a lot more in the cloud, and that gives us different opportunities to decouple in a more effective way and use different services for different workloads. So if before we were just modularizing, but in the end it was a single deployment, right now we have the ability to completely decouple, like split apart, deploy to different services or different artifacts, and then compose them back together. And when we think about static applications that maybe have some computing in a function or at the edge of the network, but the application itself, even part of the business logic, is in the front end or happens on the client side, we're thinking more about decoupled front ends and not so much about a backend application as it would be understood for business logic that happens mostly server side, right? So this is what a decoupled frontend is. It's an application that has a very important or the most important component happening client side with help of computing in the cloud or at the edge of the network. Yeah.
I think this is such a great topic because any conversation I've had with friends that are at Netlify right now, this is the entire direction that they're moving their whole company towards. And you can really see that as you're describing it being the next big architectural pattern that people start following.
Yeah, I think that that's because companies like Netlify, they started impulsing this idea or this concept of Jamstack, but Jamstack is limiting in a sense, because if you think about it, even the name, it implies that it's just JavaScript and APIs and Markdown. Whereas when you go farther to explore the cloud, you have a lot more options that may not be restricted to those three technologies. And then you also have databases and you have API gateways and you have caching mechanisms. And all those things are necessarily part of a deployment for it to be performant and effective and are not really considered in that restricted terminology. So we go now for saying like, yeah, your application could be built potentially with any framework you choose, any technology. It could be JavaScript. It could be TypeScript. You could choose a database model or another. You could do the integration in one way or another. You're just encapsulating a workload and then composing it back to a distributed system in usually via an API surface, which is the gateway or mostly the API gateway.
Well, and that makes complete sense. So at Zeal, we have a few client applications that are running, well, most of our clients are running Rails on the back end that do like computational heavy things. And it's like, I absolutely love Jamstack, but I wouldn't push that type of work to the front end to JavaScript to do that. So it makes complete sense that you would have a decoupled front end that can present the data, but is not doing the heavy lifting.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's out of, first of all, because it wouldn't be effective, but it's also out of respect for the user, right? And this is one thing that I try to promote also with this, together with this pattern, is the idea of architecting for the user experience or for the user, with the user always in mind or in a user-centric way. And then we have all this satellite of options that we can choose that converge into this API surface again in the form of an API first and event driven kind of architecture.
Is there, trying to make sure I understand like the front end composable part. So you kind of mentioned like separate deployments. Is that, are you having like separate things that you deploy for the front end specifically, or is it the idea of separating a front end from however the backend works, which could be a bunch of different services, and it can now talk to the different services through an API gateway or something like that. So is there actual separate deployments for one as part of one front-end application, or is it just separating that from however we do the deployments on the backend?
Yeah, that's a great question because the answer is actually both.
Okay.
But I can give you a concrete example. Imagine you are working in enterprise, right? And you have this banking application, right? So you do the online banking in one application that is typically a large container and it's using, I don't know, typically in enterprise, it may be C# or it may be Java, right? And then you have a front end to let the user interface with that. And let's imagine you're part of one of the teams that is working on this massive application and you have the PM come and tell you, we are going to be releasing a new product and marketing needs a landing page. That may not need be part of that larger platform that you're working on. That may be a static application that you deploy to a completely different service. So it's a completely different independent deployment that may have its own development cycle, its own release cycle. And obviously that team will have the independence or autonomy to make their own decisions in terms of what technologies they want to use and the, even the database they want to connect to. So it's effectively a different interface for the user, a decoupled front end the heavy lifting and the workload, the greatest part of it is front-end, and it's decoupled from the main application. And then you just compose it back via that upper layer of API coordination, let's say orchestration, that is the gateway. So it's both. You're separating the backend from the frontend, and at the same time, you could have yet another application that it's a mobile application, and you have it deployed to as a completely independent artifact as well, and then integrate it back.
Fair enough. I think a big takeaway from what you said is basically kind of using the right architectural deployment solution based on different needs. So you mentioned like this new website that we need, it may not need its own backend. Like it doesn't need to have a Java backend, for example, or its own. It can be a static site and it can consume services that are running and deployed in fancy ways, I guess, on the backend. And we've like mentioned the idea of API gateway or orchestrator, like however you want to phrase it. For people who may not be familiar with like multiple different deployed services representing a complete backend and using an API gateway, what's the purpose of an API gateway in that sense to kind of help these things get composed back together?
It can have different purposes. I think the main one is to consolidate APIs. So you may have an API built by one team, another one by another one, and they conform to a contract or specification that everyone should abide by. And then you make sure that any front-end, whomever and whatever way it's being developed, can connect to that API because there is documented specification, again, that is both machine and human readable. Typically, what teams use is the OpenAPI spec, right? So the API's gateway is a way to consolidate all those many APIs that may be ruled or governed by a specification or contract, and also can be used as a reverse proxy, for example, when you don't want to hit at the database directly. So for security reasons, it can be used as a token validator, for example. Mm-hmm. So you can authenticate users at an API gateway level. So basically, the API gateway has many, many different implementations or different uses or use cases, but the main one or the most important one is to route all API calls through it. And you would probably configure a domain, and then you would have subdomains. You can also have virtual networks. You can have private links, and they all converge again to this single point of control or control plane that will allow you keep your application very, very safe from the outside world. I know that it's a kind of a complex topic, but I hope I put it in a way.
You're doing a good job explaining.
Thanks.
You're doing a good job. I was going to ask, so I've done GraphQL stitching before. Is that different than this, or is that just one way of implementing this type of architecture?
Yeah, so GraphQL usually has a client that can be at an API gateway level as well, or as a function. So yes, you're doing basically something similar. You're interfacing between a database and the front end in a way that you never hit the data storage directly, mm-hmm. because that mm-hmm. would pose a security risk. But yeah, GraphQL, you can route a GraphQL API through or querying interface through the API gateway as well. There is no limitation as to which type of API you're talking to, if it's REST or it's GraphQL or it's gRPC or any of these types of API methods.
I was actually just commenting in the chat. So when I was at FedEx, we were kind of migrating to a microservices architecture, which is a brand new thing for us, and had an API gateway where we would send all of our initial requests to, it would forward to the correct service behind the scenes and all that kind of stuff. And there are lots of benefits to it, but it also kind of makes things at times a little more complicated. Testing at times was more difficult from like a local dev, because you have like, I've got to start 8 to 20 to maybe 40 different services to be able to see this thing work all the way through. And obviously you get better at like automating that sort of stuff. One of the things that could be challenging is tracing of requests. So like a request comes into API gateway, it goes to another service, how do you know like that full path, and how do you debug that sort of stuff when things go wrong? Are there any like tools inside of Azure that kind of help logging, error tracking, that sort of stuff across different services?
Yes, we have different ways to implement observability. You can do it with application insights. You can enable log streaming so you know exactly in real time when your endpoints are being hit and what is the response and what happens in the middle, even the methods that are being called before the endpoint and after the endpoint. So those are some tools that come out of the box that you can enable via the infrastructure configuration. It's not simple by any means, right? the more APIs you have connected to a gateway, obviously the orchestration becomes, a bit more challenging.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
In the functions space, so we hear a lot about serverless functions, and most of my consumption and usage of serverless functions is in an abstracted way. So something like Netlify, Vercel, I have no idea like what's going on from a deployment process behind the scenes. I just kind of give them a file and it kind of handles the deployment for me. What's the process look like for functions in Azure? I assume like, can you have GitHub integrations where you have it under source control, and when you push, it automatically kind of rebuilds and redeploys your functions, and now they're kind of out there to be consumed by your applications?
Yeah, absolutely. So basically what it is your server is managed by us, right? So you don't have to take care of configuring and putting together or starting up a server. What you do is you deploy your function, and then you probably are going to be requesting or importing your dependencies, etc. That server may be down, so it scales down to zero, what we call when you're not using a function, it goes offline, let's put it. And when you make a request to an endpoint that is served by this API, or if it's an HTTP trigger, something that hits that function, then the function starts and it does its job and then goes basically back to sleep. And yes, and definitely functions are part of your CI/CD pipeline. So you can push to them and you can update them as you are coding and pushing code via typically GitHub Actions, although it's not restricted to that. And yes, and you can have also local emulation for your functions. So you can have a local server that emulates your function in the cloud. So you can develop on this side or on your development local environment. And then when you're ready, you push your changes. Yeah.
I feel like some of the products that I've seen recently, like tested out, like people reaching out for me to do a video, for example, that's a very common feature that I think is missing from a lot of newer products, is the ability for developers to run locally. Because developers, like if you just have a dashboard and you can type code at a web browser, that's just not the same as being in your full development workflow on your computer with your terminal, with your editor, and have all the things that you're used to. So I think that's like an essential part of good developer experiences. They should be able to run and kind of emulate and test all that stuff locally.
Yeah, also for economy, right? Because anything that is happening in the cloud, in the end, it's going to have a cost. If you can run it locally until you're ready to push it to a remote environment, then it's better. But also now we're offering the ability to have full containers, like dev containers or code spaces as well, that where you can run a fully integrated composable deployment. So you can have the database or multiple databases. You can have multiple containers or microservices. You can have your front-end applications that can be one or can be several, all running in this very large container that you configure with a typically Docker file or, it's usually something related to Docker and compose it, and then run it locally. And then when you're ready, again, you commit these changes and they get pushed to the many environments that you may have configured for that, a preview or your production or however you're working. Typically a preview, or that's the advice, right? First a preview or a QA environment, then
I say production. just Just ship directly to production is usually how I do it.
Yeah. Especially on Friday, right?
on a Friday afternoon, absolutely.
Yeah.
Better if it's Friday the 13th.
Yes. Yeah, no.
It's not Friday the 13th today, right? No. We're late.
It is the 31st.
Which is, almost
first just of the 13th.
It's a lucky day today. Yeah.
There's a comment from Goose in the chat who I just realized he is an MVP for developer tools. And I haven't really shared this, but I became an MVP back in the sense there was a little bit of like ambiguity of me being an MVP for a little bit. So I didn't really share, but I'm an MVP for developer tools too. I think the most relevant thing for me was VS Code. Anyway, so Gooseman is talking about functions in Azure and talking about the integration with GitHub Actions to kind of do some of your CI/CD stuff, I think, and some of that being auto-configured when you set up functions inside of Microsoft Azure. Can you talk about like those two pieces and how they might fit together? Like how do GitHub Actions potentially play a role in some of the CI/CD stuff when you do deployments?
Yeah, basically GitHub Actions are, for those that do not know this, are a declarative way of integrating your pipelines, and you can, in the marketplace of GitHub, because many people don't know this, you have different tools that you can configure via your GitHub Actions. So for example, let's imagine you are using Playwright to do end-to-end testing, and you want to run your tests every time you push to a branch. And you want to test your endpoints. In this case, you want to test your function. So every time you make changes and you push, then the GitHub action triggers a workflow. It starts the whole building process and it runs the tests. And then if everything goes okay, well, probably you have a next step that is deployment, though not necessarily, because you are configuring all your steps of that pipeline or workflow. So yeah, usually what happens is you build, you test, you deploy, but it doesn't have to be that way. It can be in whatever way you need it. And that also allows you to define to which environment, by the way, you want to do the deployment to. And yeah, it has integrations with VS Code. Effectively, there is this Azure tools that allow you to basically interact with any service in Azure. That is, generally speaking, we target services that are in GA or general availability, but some public previews also have integration with VS Code via an extension, official extension, obviously. There are also community extensions. Yeah.
Sweet.
I saw that there was something about serverless, but I didn't have time to read it.
Yeah. Gooseman was commenting, interesting aspects with Azure Functions is you're not restricted to just serverless. You can also deploy the functions easily to an existing VM, so you don't have to pay for invocations to server time. And that's a fun like distinction, because serverless is, well, I guess it's like kind of mimicking server time, but it's just not dedicated server time. It's only the time that you're actually using it in the invocation. So it translates to being charged for invocations, versus if you already have your own VM running in Azure, you can deploy a function. And I'm so tempted always to call them serverless functions, but in this case, it would be different, because this would not be, it would just be a regular function that you can deploy to your own existing VM.
Absolutely. There are different models, and not only serverless, that are short-lived. There is the durable functions. And yes, you can package and deploy your functions to your own VMs and containers as well, as you see fit, as is part of your architecture.
So another one of the buzzwords that we hear a lot about in the serverless space is the edge. What's kind of the state of the edge story in Azure?
It's in progress, I would say. I'm not really sure I can speak about how much progress. Or I know that we are on Friendly A, but I cannot speak about it. It's in progress.
Don't get fired.
No. We have different interpretations also of what edge is. Mm-hmm. We recently launched a new model with static web apps that allows you to deploy functions in a regional sort of way. So if we detect that your user base is in a certain region, we're going to be deploying the function to that specific region, even if you chose a different one originally. So that's also, in essence, a way of edge computing because it's closer to the user, mm-hmm. which is the whole concept behind edge functions.
Yep. It's a fun buzzword. I feel like in reality, a lot of the use cases aren't as prevalent as we think. And there's still, like, I think there's a lot of education that comes around edge necessary, and then there's a lot of like the ecosystem kind of catching up to what the edge in theory promises, all of which sounds pretty vague, which I feel like is kind of the story with the edge, is that it's still pretty vague, but it's definitely talked about a lot.
This is why I was mentioning it's in progress. We have effectively edge deployments, not one-to-one right now with what other providers propose as edge. But like you said, because there is not a specific definition of edge, is something that is being executed at the edge of the network or closer to the user. And that obviously happens in Azure that has over 200 points of presence all over the world. So edge is there, right? But yeah, we're working on amazing things that are coming.
We often get little teases on the podcast of like, new things to come. That's one of my favorite moments.
Yeah.
Mine too.
All right, Amy, I'm ready for the official pivot.
Okay. Natalia, you did a fantastic project around the holidays where you also highlighted some of your design skills. And so I didn't know if you wanted to talk about your site, microfrontend.dev. It's beautiful. So everybody should go check it out.
Well, thank you so much. Coming from you, that feels like a great compliment because I'm always very impressed by your designs.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, that was because I was speaking about micro frontends and composable architectures for a very long time. And like I had articles scattered all over the place. And sometimes I would engage in conversations in podcasts through different channels. And over the holidays, I thought, like, I need to put all this together. I need to kind of put it in a format, but not really a book, because I don't have time to write a book and I don't have time to go through the edition or even have another deadline with somebody else. So I'm going to just write my own at my own pace and publish it when I feel like it's ready, even if it's not 100% complete. And I still have a backlog that it's one of the pages of the site. But I think that I'm very happy that I put that out, because now when people ask me about micro frontends, about composable architectures, about what's my opinion, about what is a thing or another, I can just link them back to my website. And yeah, I think it's helping many people. For me, the best thing about publishing content is when I get a message back from somebody telling me, I went through an interview and they asked me a question about this topic, and I knew how to answer because I had read your website, and then I passed the interview and got the job. And that's like, wow, that makes you feel like that's the greatest feeling of all, I think. So yeah, that was the motivation for me to write the website. I felt that there wasn't enough concentrated information about this subject. There were about micro frontends, but not micro frontends in the cloud or from a cloud native perspective. And I go all the way to discussing databases, to discussing WASM, to discussing more advanced topics, I think. So yeah, that's why I put together that website.
I love it.
Yeah, thank you.
And it does look so good. Are there any like fun technical things of how you built that, like front-end framework? Or are you storing data in a headless CMS? Or like, what are the details about how you built that?
I am using Astro, and it was my opportunity to use Astro because nice. I had heard great stuff about it. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it's really, really nice. And I use web components, went a little bit crazy, and I did a lot of stuff because I just wanted to try it. And the sliders, RD3. Yeah, I had the opportunity to play with technologies that I hadn't touched for a very long time because I didn't have time. And yeah, I don't know. I think it's fun to have your own website to experiment as well, which I hadn't had for a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I love your footer. In the footer, it says important. No chatbot was used or harmed in writing this content. That's awesome.
Yes, thank you.
This is the result of years working with the technology.
Yeah, because when I published it, it was around the same time with that all the hype around ChatGPT. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to make sure that people knew that this wasn't AI generated, that this was a real person writing. And it has a lot of typos. And sometimes people like send me messages and say, like, you have a typo here, you have a typo there. My intention was to open source it, but because I did some peculiar things, like it's not Markdown. Everybody thinks that it's Markdown, but it's not. It's HTML. And then because I understand the structure, and then if I open source it, I have to migrate that to I was thinking about, I had this idea of creating some sort of mechanism with decorators. So people could contribute and things would get styled in a more effective way. But yeah, I haven't found the time yet. But I'm going to do it because I want people to contribute. I really would like to open source it.
That's definitely one of the benefits of having embedded Markdown in a repo, is for people to, like, if they see that typo or whatever, they can just go and do a PR and fix that. I love the idea of the community involvement.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. 100%.
We talk a lot about content creation, which that's basically a teaching platform is what you built, right? To be able to talk about this subject and have it be a go-to resource for people. Are there other products that you've created, like content, bigger pieces of content like this that you've done in your career?
Content, you mean as educational type of content? I've wrote a lot in different places like Medium and Dev.2 and Angular in Depth, but I didn't have something that was mine. And I never did videos or streaming. I think that I'm not really good at it. So yeah, I go when I'm invited, but I don't think I would have the persistence is called. Like I wouldn't be like doing it on a regular basis because of lack of time. And yeah, and also because I don't think I'm a very fun host.
Consistency is hard. The consistency and persistence is hard.
Yeah.
And I think it's one of the biggest props that I'll give James is, you've been doing it for years.
Yeah, it's a lot of discipline to be present and to really show up and do it. Mm-hmm. And I don't think I have that. I am a bit chaotic with my schedules and sometimes I do feel like, and sometimes I'm like, no.
Well, on the flip side, I guess kind of my point with asking that is just how impressive that site looks, like the ability to put all of that information, to find all the information, whether it be like doing additional research or just based on things that you've already learned just from experience, putting it all together, but then also putting it all together in a format that makes sense for a consumer to the extent that you did is a really major accomplishment. And so like I do things consistently, but I don't have many bigger things that I've put together like that, that I'm super proud of. So I guess I wanted to kind of celebrate in reverse. That's a pretty major accomplishment, I think, to put all of that into one neat package for people to consume.
I want to mention that in my role as an end-to-end PM, content is also part of my scope. Mm. So I do a lot of content revisioning and planning and support. And in my previous job, I was the lead for the whole front-end development department, and I maintained our wiki with a lot of internal documentation as well as part of that role. So I have experience putting content together in a way that has and I'm also a data architect. So I have this experience with architecting basically a data structure. So I think that's where it comes from, but I appreciate your comment and thank you so much. Made my day.
You're very welcome. All right. I don't know if this is like uncomfortable, but I'll brag again for you because we haven't talked about this and you didn't introduce yourself in this way, but I think formally your title is principal lead for JavaScript DX on Azure. Yeah. Is that right? So to me, like there's like conversations of whether or not like, should you introduce yourself as principal, et cetera. And like that aside, I think principal means a lot. And I think especially at a tech company like Microsoft, like that carries a lot of weight and that's really impressive. So I guess part of me is just like, wow, that's really cool. I don't know if there's any like learnings that you've had of like getting to that level as a principal? Anything that like you think you've done that's had a big impact on what I would consider success in a career?
I joined Microsoft already as a principal, but in the previous company, before Microsoft, I worked at MongoDB, but before that, I used to work at a startup that was acquired by Cognizant, and Cognizant is a very large international consultancy company, and we were partners with Adobe, and I was also working with Adobe a lot and being part of their open source projects. And in that company, I joined as a professional level developer because I was a freelancer before and all my experience was in smaller agencies. And then 2 years later, I was promoted to senior. And 2 years later, I was promoted to principal engineer.
Nice.
And all I can say is it's a lot of hard work. And many, many, many times we speak about the glorious side of being in a higher role, I don't know, higher up the ladder, whatever you want to call it, but you have to also be very consistent and very persistent to get there. But one important thing is to keep, you know, humble, and it's just a role within your organization that means that you have more responsibility, not necessarily more power or more authority. So, yeah, my responsibility right now is with the developers and the Azure developer community. And I want to make sure that I use that role name in their favor always. And that's my goal. That's
what I love that.
Yeah. It's well said.
Yeah. I didn't expect anything else other than a humble response from you. But I always like to call those things out for people, because oftentimes, like, I don't think you would go out and brag about being a principal, but I think it is worth like celebrating for yourself and for other people to see what like that dedication looks like to get to that point. So thanks for sharing that.
Thank you so much.
The next section of our episode is Picks and Plugs, where we share something that we like. Doesn't have to be tech related, and then we plug something generally that we've worked on. So Natalia, do you want to share a pick and plug?
Wow, I am totally unprepared for that. You say it doesn't have to be tech, because I am so tech.
It could be tech. It just doesn't have to be. Anything that you enjoy.
Oh, I enjoy traveling. I enjoy being with my family. I enjoy surfing. I enjoy, skating. These kind of things I enjoy. But also, again, giving back to the community. I was part of the Women Tech Makers here in Barcelona, now no longer. But being able to encourage women to start public speaking is one of the things that I really dedicate some time to. And I was also a mentor for Google Road to GDE because of the same reason. Sometimes women feel like they cannot go in front of a crowd and speak and they don't feel safe. And then telling them like, it's okay. Like if you have the passion and you go and you have prepared your topic, you're fine. Let's do it. I'll be there for you. Yeah. That's what I wanted to plug on. Like basically if you have the ability to help somebody move forward with their aspirations, just do it.
Yeah.
You had mentioned that Natalia and I met at Jamstack. She actually facilitated a panel at Jamstack, which I feel like again is next level.
Yeah. That's awesome. Natalia, you mentioned traveling. Do you have like a favorite travel accessory, like something that you take with you on all your trips?
No, I have something that I don't take with me when I travel. my laptop or anything work related. That's a lesson learned over the
Good
years.
For you.
Yeah. Whenever I am on vacations, when I was like younger, I used to, I would take everything and be very stressed. Now I'm like, I'm on vacations. Bye.
That's great. I love the flip of that. No, I have something I don't take with me. That's good.
Yeah.
Yep.
Love it. Amy, do you want to go next?
Yeah, sure. So I'm going to pick a podcast that I say just started listening to. I've only listened to one episode. So take it with a grain of salt, but it's called Startups for the Rest of Us. And it's been around for a while. I think I listened to episode 653. But the guy behind it is, he created Drip, if you've used that email service provider platform, and then sold it. So he has lots of money. He's created several startups in his lifetime, but he talks about some of the lessons that he's learned and that other people are learning through creating SaaS and through creating software. So one of the things that was interesting to me about this particular episode was he said, when you start off, like define what will happen if I succeed. And he said, why that's important is because usually people see success as a moving target. Like, you know, we're talking about achieving principal engineer. Once I achieve principal, I'll have made it. I'll have been successful. But at that point, there's still something else that you just keep thinking, I'm going to reach for this. And so he was saying, if you can define those things on the onset, then you can actually really enjoy and appreciate the success once you get to that point. So anyways, I really enjoyed that particular episode and just some of the things that he had to say. So that is called Startups for the Rest of Us. And then, yeah, for the plug, I'm going to plug my Twitch streams. I've been streaming again, which has been fun. So most mornings, 3 times a week at 9 a.m. Central, and my handle is SelfTeachMe. So that's on Twitch. But we've been going through a Zeta project, which has been fun to build in public.
Nice.
Very cool. I will pick not something that's like super novel, but it's something I used recently, which is the Roku Stick. So a 4K one. So it just plugs into an HDMI port and a TV. Then you have access to all the apps and things, Netflix, Hulu, all those things. So the use case for me was, we have kind of an older TV, and I think it actually technically has internet, but we tried connecting it to Netflix and Hulu, and it like something failed. I think it's just old. So anyway, on our deck outside, we mounted that TV and haven't really been able to use it. And because of that, so we've had it out there but not used it. And so I bought a Roku Stick, plugged it in, signed up, and have access to all those things. You can also use your phone as a remote for Roku. So like if we lose the remote, we can just use our phone to turn it on and go and watch whatever, which is really neat. We have a plug, an outlet that we had someone put outside on the brick of our house, but so we could plug this stuff in. So I bought an extender with multiple ports on it to just like leave it up near the TV, plug the TV in. We also have our lights plugged into it too. So really happy, like after doing a decent amount of work to like get lights up there and mount a TV like months ago, that now we have it fully set up where I can just walk outside, press power on the remote and watch TV, which is fun.
Nice.
And then for me,
it's been beautiful outside.
It's been. Yeah. Well, and we also had a cold day recently, and this is an interesting time for Tennessee because it could be up and down, but a lot of it has been really good for me. I guess I'll plug TikTok. So I do at least a couple of videos typically every week on TikTok of JavaScript challenges or like satire for developers or just like learnings in my career, that kind of stuff. So if you're interested in following me on TikTok, it's James Q Quick.
I have to say that I've seen some of those pop up in my Twitter feed, and they are hilarious. Like the satire ones.
Mm-hmm. I really enjoy doing them. They're funny. I haven't done, Sion mentioned dancing ones. I haven't done any dancing ones. Maybe one day.
How about a rap one?
A rap one. I haven't written a song in a long time, which is usually like, I can tell when I get in like a mood, and it's like a big outlet, and I don't know if I just haven't had that day yet, but I've been thinking about writing something recently. So one day.
Wow. Full of creative people.
Yeah.
Which is like, it's all about perspective. Cause I think of myself as like the least creative person, but it's all relative, right? I think most of it's just look at other people and look at things that they do and just assume we're not as good as they are. Like, it's just such a common reaction. Sometimes you just need to appreciate yourself.
Yeah. And not compare yourself with others. We all have our own particularities. Yep. You see, I said it right.
Nailed it.
You did better than me.
I don't think.
Nailed it.
Particularities. I don't know if I've ever actually said that word.
I also have trouble with the word similarly.
Similarly? Well, that's definitely not a word.
No, similarly. Yeah,
I know.
Similarly.
Similarly. And that is going to wrap it up for this episode. Hope you all enjoyed it. If you're listening on the podcatcher of choice, make sure to leave a rating and review so that we can continue to do more episodes and have more amazing guests like Natalia on the podcast. Thanks everyone for listening. In the meantime, that's all we got.